St. Mark's Square. Venice was once Europe's richest and most cosmopolitan city, and the center of it all was Piazza San Marco, St. Mark's Square. Hi, I'm Rick Steves. Thanks for joining me on a walk around the square with its dazzling monuments, rich history, and love of life. As middleman in trade between Europe and the exotic East, the wealthy Venetians taught the rest of Europe the good life. Venice was a vibrant city full of painted palaces, glittering canals, wine, women, and song, and mobs of visitors from everywhere. Centuries later, Venice is all of these still, with the added charm of romantic decay. Allow about an hour for this audio tour as we see the one-of-a-kind basilica, the Palace of the Doges, the shops, the music-filled cafes, and the magical piazza they enclose. To help us along the way, I've invited a good friend and virtual travel buddy. Ciao, Lisa.
Buongiorno, Rick.
Lisa will give us helpful directions and sightseeing tips throughout the tour.
And my first tip is to be sure you get our tour updates. Just press the icon at the lower right of your device. You'll find any updates and helpful instructions unique to this tour.
Things like closures, opening hours, and reservation requirements.
There's also tips on how to use this audio tour and even the full printed script.
Yes, so pause for just a moment right now to review our updates and special tips.
It's okay, we'll wait.
Now, let's go to
St. Mark's Square.
The tour begins. The Piazza.
For an overview of this grand square, view it from the far end. That is, away from St. Mark's Basilica. Basilica San Marco dominates the square with its onion domes and glowing mosaics. Mark Twain said it looked like a vast, warty bug taking a meditative walk.
I say it looks like a bunch of tiara-topped ladybugs copulating.
Yeah, thanks for that image, Rick. From the far end of the square, stand and just take it all in. The historic buildings, the cafes, the tourists.
The restoration work. Unfortunately, there's always something covered for restoration.
One thing that never changes are the shops and the sheer expanse of open space. Rick?
The square is big, about 2.5 acres, but it feels intimate with its cafes and dueling orchestras. At the far end is the basilica. To the right of the basilica is its 300-foot-tall bell tower, or campanile. Between the basilica and the campanile, you can catch a glimpse of the pale pink Doge's palace. Lining the square are the former government offices that administered the Venetian Empire's vast network of trading outposts, which, back in the 13th century, stretched all the way to Turkey. By day, the piazza is great for people-watching and pigeon-chasing. By night, under lantern light, it transports you to another century, complete with its own romantic soundtrack. Napoleon called the piazza the most beautiful drawing room in Europe. Today, the piazza draws Indians in saris, English nobles in blue blazers, Nebraskans in shorts, and elegantly dressed pickpockets. Hey, if all you did was plunk yourself down here and watch the world go by, to me, that's a vacation. For architecture buffs, here are 3 centuries of styles, bam, 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 side by side, uno, due, tre, for easy comparison. On the left side of the square, that's left as you face the basilica, are the so-called old offices, built in about 1500 in solid column and arch Renaissance style. The new offices, on the right, in a high Renaissance style from a century later, are a little heavier and more ornate. This wing mixes arches, statues in the Baroque style, and the 3 classical orders of columns. From the bottom to top, find Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian. The wing farthest from the church, the part you're under, was built by Napoleon in the neoclassical style. It's a return to simpler, more austere classical columns and arches. Step out into the square, turn your back to the church, and look up. You'll see how Napoleon's architects tried to make this wing bridge the styles of the other two. But it turned out a little too high for one side and just not enough for the other. Nice try. Napoleon's Wing also houses the Carrère Museum. Though it's not a blockbuster site, it does have some interesting artifacts of the Doges, gleaming statues by Antonio Canova, and paintings by the illustrious Bellini family. It's also a quiet refuge from the hubbub of St. Mark's Square and a clever place to buy your ticket without a line to the often crowded Doge's Palace. All around the square, watch out for pigeon speckle. If bombed, resist the urge to wipe it off immediately. It'll just smear. Let it dry, and it'll flake off cleanly. The best way to get the pigeons to flutter airborne is not to yell, but to toss your sweater in the air. The pigeons, for centuries a colorful part of the square, are seen increasingly as a problem. And the city is looking for ways to control the pigeon population. Population.
Ah, the magic of Venice. On another practical note, the tourist office is to your right in the corner of the square, and a pay toilet is behind you, just outside the piazza. Now, start approaching the basilica.
But hey, it's Venice, and you have permission to do whatever you want. Hang out here if it's too hot or too rainy. Or feel free to browse around the square as you slowly make your way to the basilica.
As you roam, listen to the next track as Rick talks about the cafes. And we'll meet up again at St. Mark's Basilica.
The cafes. Cafes line the square, each with their own orchestra. Venice has a long tradition as a city of music, especially from the powdered wig Baroque era of the 16 and 1700s. This was the hometown of Antonio Vivaldi, composer of the Four Seasons. Yeah, that one. These days, the city is dotted with young people in 17th century costumes selling tickets to touristy Baroque concerts in atmospheric settings. On the square, all three cafes feature similar food, similar prices, and a 3 or 4 piece combo playing a selection of classical and pop hits from Brahms to Bessame Mucho. Every night, enthusiastic musicians play the same songs, creating the same irresistible magic. Café Florian, the one on the right as you face the church, has been a popular spot for a discreet rendezvous since 1720, when coffee was the trendy new beverage in Europe. Today, its orchestra plays a more classical repertoire than the other cafes. The outside tables are the main action, but inside are richly decorated old-time rooms where Casanova, Lord Byron, Charles Dickens, and Woody Allen have all paid too much for a drink. Café Quadri, opposite the Florian, has an equally illustrious history, having hosted the likes of the writer Stendhal and opera composer Richard Wagner. The other cafes, though lively, are newer and less prestigious. If you'd like to sit at a cafe table and enjoy the music, expect to pay about 15 euros for the cover charge and a drink. Sure, it's pricey, but once you've paid, it's perfectly acceptable to nurse your cappuccino or glass of wine as long as you want. Even if you don't pay to sit, you're always welcome to linger around the fringes and soak up the ambiance for free. It doesn't cost a single euro to dance on the square under a ceiling of stars. A once-in-a-lifetime memory. St. Mark's is the perfect place to sip a glass of wine, admire the Byzantine architecture of the church, and listen while the band plays New York, New York.
Okay, now turn your attention to St. Mark's Basilica with its colorful facade.
St. Mark's Basilica, the exterior. The church is one of Europe's oldest, dedicated in 1063. The church and the square are named for St. Mark, an early follower of Jesus who wrote the story of Jesus' life in the Gospel of Mark. According to legend, Mark visited Venice in his travels, and Venetians claim that his mortal remains lie here, under the main altar. Though this structure is nearly 1,000 years old, it's only the most recent church that stood here since Venice's birth. Venice was founded back in the 5th and 6th centuries, when the Roman Empire was falling. Rome's infrastructure was crumbling, and Italy was crawling with barbarians. Ravaged mainlanders fled to marshy islands in the Adriatic, like Venice. They sank pilings into the mud to make foundations for structures like St. Mark's Basilica. As time passed, these fishermen became sea traders. Soon, humble Venice became rich, trading Western European goods with Turkish Muslims and Byzantine Christians. Their trade empire stretched all the way to Turkey. St. Mark's Square was the exact center of this east-west axis. Study the basilica's facade. It reflects this crazy mix of east and west. You'll see Roman-style arches over doorways, Greek-style columns in between, golden Byzantine mosaics, a roofline ringed with pointed French Gothic pinnacles, and Muslim-style onion domes on the roof. By the way, the domes are made of wood covered with lead. The building is made of bricks blanketed in marble. And the decoration came from everywhere in Venice's trading empire. Notice how the columns are all different. Some purple, some green, gray, yellow, some speckled, some striped horizontally, some vertically, all topped with a variety of different capitals. The four bronze horses above the central doorway are the most cherished bit of booty. They were taken from the Byzantine capital of Constantinople, that's present-day Istanbul, in 1204. When you go inside St. Mark's, you'll see the church's most distinct feature. It's wallpapered with colorful mosaics, a Byzantine specialty. What's amazing about St. Mark's is that the entire thing comes together in a bizarre sort of harmony. It remains simply the most interesting church in Europe, a church that, paraphrasing Goethe, can only be compared with itself.
If you plan to go inside St. Mark's during your visit, we have another audio tour on the church. But for now, face the basilica and turn 90 degrees to the left and check out the clock tower.
The clock tower. Atop the clock tower, which dates from about 1500, stand two bronze Moors, or African Muslims. Built originally to be giants, they only gained their ethnicity when the metal darkened over the centuries. At the top of each hour, these guys swing their giant clappers. The clock dial shows the 24 hours, the signs of the zodiac, and, in the blue center, the phases of the moon. Above the dial is the world's first digital clock. It changes every 5 minutes. The clock tower retains some of its original coloring of blue and gold, a reminder that, in centuries past, this city glowed with bright colors. An alert winged lion, the symbol of both St. Mark and the city, looks down on the crowded square. He opens a book that reads, Pax Tibi Marse, or Peace Be With You, Mark. As legend goes, these were the comforting words an angel spoke to the stressed-out evangelist during a stormy night right here on this island. Eventually, St. Mark's body found its final resting place inside the basilica, and now his lion symbol is everywhere. They really are everywhere. As a matter of fact, here, find four lions in 20 seconds. Ready, set, go. Let's see, there's one there on the clock. And there's one over there, yeah. Up on the church, probably a lot on the church. Way over there, there's another one. All right, got it. Four lions. They really are everywhere. The pair of lions squatting on the ground between the clock tower and the basilica have probably been photographed being ridden by every Venetian child born since the dawn of cameras. Venice's many lions express the city's various mood swings through history. Triumphant after a naval victory. Sad when a favorite son has died. Hollow-eyed after a plague. And smiling when the soccer team wins. Under the arch of the clock tower is the start of the street called the Merceria, the main drag that winds from St. Mark's all the way to the Rialto Bridge, lined with upscale shops.
Did someone mention shopping? Venice has plenty of that. To get a taste, browse along the side of the square under the arcade.
Shops and local crafts. Long a city of aristocrats, luxury goods, and merchants, Venice was built to entice. Since the 1200s, Venice has had a reputation for fine quality glass products, like vases, decanters, and beaded necklaces. If you're serious about glass, you can see glassblowing demonstrations on Murano Island, where the craft got its start. Prices, however, are usually no better on Murano than you'll find in Venice. Masks are another popular item. In the 1700s, when Venice was Europe's party town, visiting nobles from England or France donned masks for anonymity in order to do the kinds of things here that were forbidden back home. At Carnevale, the weeks-long Mardi Gras leading up to Lent, everyone wore masks. The most popular masks were based on characters from the lowbrow comedic theater called Commedia dell'arte. The mask of the servant Harlequin, the long-nosed mask of the quack doctor, pretty Colombina, and so on. At Carnevale, all social classes partied as one because, as they say, the mask levels all distinctions. Lace making has also been an art form in Venice since medieval times. For handkerchiefs, doilies, and ornamental lace, you can visit the island of Burano, home to local artisans. Besides traditional products, the city is also totally global, up on all the latest trends in fashion and accessories. While no one claims Venice is great for bargains, it does have a shopping charm that makes paying too much strangely enjoyable.
Rick, put the lace tea cozy down and back away. It's time to pry ourselves from the shops and stroll across the square to the 300-foot-tall bell tower, or campanile.
The campanile. The original campanile, or bell tower, was also the lighthouse guarding the entrance to the Grand Canal. It was a marvel of 10th-century architecture, until the 20th century, when it toppled into the center of the piazza. One night in 1902, it groaned ominously, sending people scurrying from the cafes. The next morning, crash! The golden angel on top landed right at the basilica's front door, standing up. The campanile was rebuilt 10 years later, complete with its golden angel, which always faces the breeze. You can ride a lift 300 feet up to the top for the best view in Venice. It's crowded at peak times, but well worth it. Be at the top when the bells ring on the hour for an unforgettable experience.
Now direct your attention to the base of the campanile and find a tiny stone plaque. It's on the side facing the square near the campanile's exit door.
It's about knee-high or 3 feet above the pavement. This plaque shows the high water line from the disastrous floods of 1966. 196 centimeters, or more than 6 feet. In recent years, this square floods 50 times in a typical winter.
While we're here, Rick, tell us more about the flooding.
Floods in Venice. Imagine this square full of water, with gondolas floating where people now sip cappuccinos. That happens every so often at very high tides, called acqua alta, a reminder that Venice and the sea are intertwined. The puddles appear first at the round white pavement stones, like the one next to the campanile. Since St. Mark's Square is the first place in town to start flooding, it's an obvious place to take tidal measurements. The gauges on the campanile show the current sea level, or livello maria. If the tide is mild, around 30 centimeters or 20 inches above sea level, the water merely seeps up through the pavement stones. But when there's a strong tide, about 65 centimeters, it looks like someone's turned on a faucet down below. The water bubbles upward and flows like a river to the lowest points in the square, which can be covered with a few inches of water in an hour or so. When this happens, a warning siren goes off. Imagine being a Venetian and hearing the alarm. You rush home to roll up your carpets and raise your furniture above the incoming salt water. Many doorways have 3-foot-high wooden or metal barriers to block the high water, but the seawater still manages to seep in through floors and drains. After the water recedes, you have to be very careful to clean everything it touched to minimize the damage caused by the corrosive salt water. The Aqua Alta occurs about 100 times a year, most seriously in March and November around full moon. This is when the barometric pressure and warm Scirocco winds from Africa push the Mediterranean waters northward up against this far end of the Adriatic. Venetians do what they can to ride out the Aqua Alta. You might see stacked wooden benches in the square. During floods, the benches are placed end to end to create elevated sidewalks. In 2006, the pavement around St. Mark's Square was all taken up, and the entire height of the square was raised by adding a layer of sand and then replacing the stones. Venice has been battling rising water levels since the 5th century. But today, with global warming, the water is winning.
The big building to the right of St. Mark's Basilica, the one with the frilly pink and white exterior, is the Doge's Palace.
The Doge's Palace. The wedding cake, the tablecloth, or the pink house is also sometimes known as the Doge's Palace. This palace housed the fascinating government of this rich and powerful empire. It also served as the home for the Venetian ruler known as the Doge, or Duke. For four centuries, from about 1150 to 1550, this was the most powerful half-acre in Europe. The exterior is lacy and unprotected, a far cry from the heavy medieval castles of England or France. The rest of Europe marveled at the way Venice could govern itself without a dominant king, bishop, or tyrant. This unfortified palace in a city with no protective wall was the Doge's way of saying, "I am an elected and loved ruler. I do not fear my own people." As middleman in the trade between Europe and Asia, Venice reaped wealth from both sides. In 1450, Venice had 180,000 citizens, far more than London, and a gross domestic product that exceeded that of entire countries. Venetian sea traders, backed by military might, controlled trading outposts in the Adriatic, Greece, and Turkey. At home, the Doge was the CEO of an efficient, state-operated multinational corporation. He was elected by a council of nobles and presided over a stable constitutional government. The Doges wanted their palace to reflect the wealth and secular values of the Republic, impressing visitors and serving as a reminder that Venetians were number one in Europe. Inside, the Doge's palace is virtually wallpapered with big, colorful canvases by Venice's great artists, Titian, Tintoretto, and Veronese. They showed doges kneeling before gods and beautiful women dressed in luxurious clothes who represent the city of Venice, lording it over its rivals. The Doge's Palace is the epitome of the style known as Venetian Gothic. You'll see the traditional pointed Gothic arches, but with a Venetian flair. They're curved to a point, ornamented with a three-leaf clover, and topped with a round medallion of a four-leaf clover. The pattern is found on the Doge's Palace and on buildings all over Venice, but found nowhere else in the world. Well, except Las Vegas. Notice that the support columns are short and have no bases, giving the palace a top-heavy look. Originally, there were bases, but over the centuries, these were covered over. As the sea level rose, the square was built up with new paving stones, buying a little more time as the sea slowly swallows the city.
The small square between the basilica and the water is known as the Piazzetta. This so-called little square is framed by the Doge's Palace on one side and the Campanile and the Marciana Library on the other. We'll start at the base of the Campanile and work clockwise around the Piazzetta to see some of its unusual sights.
The Piazzetta. The delicate white entrance porch at the base of the Campanile is known as the Loggetta. It was designed by Jacopo Sansovino. Around 1530, he built this, as well as the Marciana Library, opposite the Doge's Palace. Sansovino's work featured round arches rather than the pointed arches of Venetian Gothic, paving the way for the Renaissance and Baroque buildings that now dot much of the city. From the Loggetta, continue clockwise around the Piazzetta. Where the Doge's Palace connects with St. Mark's Basilica, you'll find a purple sculpture of four small figures. For centuries, these four statues made of porphyry marble, known as the Tetrarchs, have guarded the traditional entrance to the Doge's Palace. Though no one knows exactly who they are, I like the legend that says they're the scared leaders of a divided Rome during its fall, clutching their swords and each other as all hell breaks loose around them. Turn your attention to the columns of the Doge's Palace facade. Walk along the columns toward the water. Then, starting at the end by the waterfront, count inland seven columns. At the seventh column from the water, look up at the top of the column to the capital carved with scenes. They tell a story of love, romance, and tragedy. Start on the side facing the Piazzetta and circle the column counterclockwise. In the first scene, a woman on a balcony is wooed by her lover. He says, "Babe, I want you." In the next scene, the lady responds,
"What, little old me?"
Next, they get married. And then, in the next scene, they kiss. Then, they hit the sack. Pretty racy for 14th century art. 9 months later, guess what? The baby takes its first steps. Unfortunately, the tale ends with a scene that was all too common in the 1300s. The child dies. Near the water are two large columns with statues on top. These 12th century columns were looted from Constantinople. In former times, the columns were used to execute criminals in hopes that the public could learn its lessons vicariously. Mark's winged lion sits on top of one. The lion's body, nearly 15 feet long, predates the wings and is more than 2,000 years old. The other column holds St. Theodore, battling a crocodile. Theodore was the original patron saint who was replaced by Mark. I guess stabbing crocs in the back just wasn't classy enough for an upwardly mobile world power.
Head for the water's edge lined with gondolas. Step out onto one of the wooden piers and survey the scene. The waterfront promenade is called the Riva. A stroll to the right, that's right as you face the water, would lead to the San Marco Vaporetto stop, the small Giardinetti Reale Park, and another tourist office. To the left, along the Riva, past the Doge's Palace, are some of Venice's most famous luxury hotels, such as the posh Daniele Hotel. Stand here where the water laps against the Piazzetta and gaze across the water.
The Lagoon. Venice was known as the Bride of the Sea because she was dependent on sea trade for her livelihood. Every year this marriage was celebrated by the people. The Doge, in full regalia, boarded a ritual boat, his Air Force One. From here at the edge of the Piazzetta, he sailed out into the lagoon. There a vow was made, and he tossed a jeweled ring into the water to reaffirm the marriage. The island of Venice sits in a lagoon, a calm section of the Adriatic protected from wind and waves. The protection comes from the natural breakwater of an island called the Lido. That's the strip of land you can see in the distance to your left as you face the water. The lagoon is big, 212 square miles, and encloses a number of islands besides Venice, including Murano, Burano, and Torcello, all easily reached from here by Vaporetto. Though big, the lagoon is very shallow. You could walk across most of it without getting your hair wet. The shallow water and treacherous sandbars made the Isle of Venice safe from attack by land or sea. It's the only great medieval city that never needed a wall. Look in the distance. On an island across the lagoon is one of the grandest scenes in the city, the Church of San Giorgio Maggiore. The church looks like a Greek temple, with a brilliant white entryway of four tall columns topped by a triangular pediment. It was designed in the 16th century by Andrea Palladio, whose style inspired centuries of Greek-style architecture right down to American government and bank buildings. Alongside the church is its bell tower, which echoes the campanile on St. Mark's Square. You can climb that bell tower, and a trip out to San Giorgio Maggiore is worth it, if only for the view from the top. Looking back at St. Mark's Square, it gives you a classic view of Venice. Panning your gaze to the right, find the guy balancing on a big bronze ball. He stands atop the old customs house, which guards the entrance to the Grand Canal. To the right of that, up the Grand Canal a bit, is the majestic dome of La Salute Church. By the way, are the crowds getting to you? The area around St. Mark's can get really crowded. If so, here are a few relatively quiet spots you can escape to nearby. You could sip a cappuccino in the Carrère Museum Café overlooking the square, or in the plush, if pricey, interior of Café Florian. For a small slice of greenery, try the Giardinetti Reali Park. It's just along the waterfront. The Salute Church and San Giorgio Maggiore are rarely crowded, and both just a short Vaporetto ride away. Above all, make a point to get away from the crowded tourist axis running from St. Mark's to the Rialto. The main sight to see in Venice is the city itself. Wander the back lanes. Don't worry about getting lost. Get as lost as possible. Keep reminding yourself, I'm on an island and I can't get off. Find your own quiet canal or time pass square and discover what makes this city so unique.
One of the things that makes Venice unique are the boats docked along the waterfront of the Piazzetta, gondolas.
Gondolas. For centuries, the best way to get around the shallow marshy lagoon was on boats called gondolas. To navigate over the countless shifting sandbars, the boats were flat, with no keel or rudder, and the captains stood up to see. A single oar both propels and steers the boat. The gondola is built curved a bit on one side so that a single oar thrusting from that side sends the boat in a straight line. A typical gondola is 35 feet long and 5 feet wide and weighs about 1,000 pounds. They travel about 3 miles an hour, same speed as walking, and take no more energy to row than it does to walk. They're always painted black. That's because of a 17th century law designed to eliminate competition between nobles for the fanciest rig. But each gondola has unique upholstery, trim, and detailing, such as the squiggly-shaped carved wood oarlock called a furcula and the metal hood ornament known as a ferro. 200 years ago, there were 10,000 gondolas in Venice. Today, there are only about 500, used only for tourists. There are about 400 licensed gondoliers. When one dies, the license passes to his widow. For some visitors to Venice, a gondola ride is a tacky ripoff. For others, a romantic memory of a lifetime. A 40-minute ride through the canals costs roughly 80 euros during the day, and 25% more at night when it's more romantic. For musica, a singer and accordionist, add an additional 50%. You can divide the cost and the romance by up to 6 people per boat. Establish the price before boarding, enjoy your ride, and pay only when you're finished. If it fits your style and budget, take a nighttime gondola ride. Glide through Venice with your head on someone's shoulder. Follow the moon as it sails past otherwise unseen buildings. You're anonymous in the city of masks, as silhouettes gaze down from bridges and glorious window glitter spills onto the... Venice does this to me. I'm sorry. I digress. Okay. As for the gondoliers, in their striped shirts and straw hats, women beware. They can be extremely charming, but the locals warn that anyone who falls for one of these Romeos has slices of ham over her eyes.
Facing the water, turn left and walk along the Riva. We're headed for the first bridge just past the Doge's Palace. As you walk, listen to the next phase of Venice's history, and we'll meet up again on top of the bridge.
Elegant decline. Venice peaked around 1500. Its wealth had come from sea trade, but in the next centuries, the economy stagnated. a victim of new trade options, such as the newly discovered Americas, new European powers like England, France, and Spain, and belligerent Turks, who eventually took over Venice's trade outposts. At home, however, Venice retained its reputation as a luxury-loving, exotic playground, with more than a hint of decadence. Even back then, it was a popular tourist destination. English and French nobles came here to indulge in things they couldn't do back home. With licensed casinos and a reputed 20,000 courtesans, that is, prostitutes, it was Europe's Sin City.
What happened in Venice stayed in Venice.
Carnevale was a great winter getaway, and every night there was another masked ball. Imagine dancing under candlelit chandeliers to Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Servants glide by with drinks and finger foods. The gentlemen wear powdered wigs, silk shirts with lacy sleeves, velvet coats and breeches, striped stockings, and shoes with big shiny buckles. They carry snuff boxes with dirty pictures inside the lids. The ladies powdered their hair and pile it high. And everyone carries a mask on a stick to change identity in a split second. This was the era of Giacomo Casanova, a real-life person who wrote an exaggerated autobiography. Born and raised in Venice, Casanova roamed Europe's capitals as a living, breathing example of the Venice that so entranced the rest of Europe. A gambler, scholar, political rebel, and lover of the female sex, he gained a reputation as a rake, rogue, and rapscallion. As he wrote in his memoirs, "I began to lead a life of complete freedom, caring for nothing except what pleased me."
When you reach the first bridge past the Doge's Palace, climb to the top and look inland. Spanning the canal, you'll see a covered passageway that bridges two buildings.
The Bridge of Sighs. On the left is the Doge's Palace. On the right, the prisons. It may look like a palace, but notice the bars on the windows. The Bridge of Sighs connects the two. In the Doge's Palace, the government doled out justice. The condemned crossed to the prisons by way of this covered bridge. It was originally known as the Prisons Bridge. Then in the 19th century, the romantic poet Lord Byron renamed it and gave it a fanciful legend that the convicted paused on the bridge, pondered their future in the dark, dank prisons, looked out and got one last view of sunny, joyous Venice, and sighed. Today, you can cross the bridge and tour the prisons as part of a visit to the Doge's Palace. Venice is a city of beautiful facades, palaces, churches, carnival masks, but they can cover darker interiors of intrigue and decay. The Bridge of Sighs, with its elegant exterior, hides the fact that Venice, the self-proclaimed most serene republic, was far from serene in its later years. The city developed a worldwide reputation for swift, harsh, and secret justice. Suspected traitors, murderers, and morals violators could be accused anonymously, swept off the streets, tried, judged, and thrown directly into the dank prisons without so much as a Miranda warning. Casanova served time in the Doge's Palace prison. Despite Venice's mask of gaiety, in the 1700s it was a poor, politically bankrupt, dirty city. But its reputation for decay and sleaze was actually romanticized into a metaphor for adventures into shady immorality. 1797 marks the end of the Venetian Republic. That's when Venice was conquered by Napoleon and the Doges were kicked out. Shortly after that, the city fell under Austrian rule, and it stayed there until the reunification of Italy. Throughout the 1800s, romantics like Lord Byron visited here as part of the so-called Grand Tour of must-see sites for European aristocrats. In the 20th century, there was little new building done in the city, and Venice remained a museum piece for foreigners, one increasingly threatened by mainland pollution, floods, and hordes of tourists. Venice has been a major tourist center for four centuries. Anyone who's ever come here has stood on this very spot and pondered the Bridge of Sighs. lean on the railing leaned on by everyone from Casanova to Byron to Hemingway. As Lord Byron wrote, I stood in Venice at the Bridge of Sighs, a palace and a prison on each hand. I saw from out the wave her structures rise, as from the stroke of the enchanter's wand. 1,000 years their cloudy wings expand around me, and a dying glory smiles o'er the far times, when many a subject land looked to the winged line's marble piles, where Venice sat in state, throned on her 100 isles.
Take one last look at the peaceful lagoon before returning to the crowded and sweaty St. Mark's Square and sigh. Or from here, you can continue along the Riva for more views. But wherever your path takes you, don't miss one of Venice's great sights.
Venice by night. Save some energy to experience Venice after dark. Evenings are made for wandering. Even Venice's dark and distant back lanes are considered very safe after nightfall. When the sun goes down, the masses of day trippers go home, and Venice resumes its position as Europe's most romantic city. A cool breeze blows in from the lagoon, the lanterns come on, and even the peeling plaster glows in the moonlight. This is the time to enjoy the orchestras on St. Mark's Square, dancing under a ceiling of stars. Sip a glass of wine, and even the schmaltziest music becomes molto romantico. Wander the back lanes. Pop into a bar for some cicchetti, that's the local tapas, and a spritz. Linger over dinner. Lick a little gelato. Discover the magic and mystery that have attracted visitors since the days of Casanova. Don a mask, or even just a clean shirt, and become someone else for a night. We hope you've enjoyed this walk through St. Mark's Square. If you're up for more sightseeing, we have other audio tours available for more Venice sights: St. Mark's Basilica, the Frari Church, and the Grand Canal Cruise. Remember, this tour was excerpted from the Rick Steves Venice Guidebook, co-authored with Gene Openshaw. For more details on eating, sleeping, or sightseeing in Venice, refer to this year's edition of that guidebook. For more free audio tours and podcasts, and for information about our TV shows, bus tours, and travel gear, visit our website at ricksteves.com. Thanks to Gene Openshaw, co-author of this tour. This tour was produced by Cedar House Audio Productions. Grazie.
Arrivederci.
And buon viaggio.